This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's weekly news and current affairs show, covering the stories that matter to our community.
G'day, I'm David Moyle. Welcome to The Informer. The Informer is back after a six-month hiatus with a brand new executive producer, Toby Halligan. Toby is a comedian and journalist who's worked at The Project, 3RRR, Mad as Hell, and The Weekly with Charlie Pickering. He is passionate about equality, political comedy, and his greyhound, Banjo, and he's very proud to be joining Joy and The Informer. The Informer may have changed format, but we're proud of the work that previous seasons of The Informer have done. You'll be hearing from some of the team members who've worked on previous seasons throughout this year. But we're always looking for more voices. If you'd like to get involved, have a story idea or some feedback, email theinformer@joy.org.au or get in touch with us on Facebook or Twitter. But first, there's a little news story that broke today, something about a federal election. Our new EP, Toby Halligan, is here to update us. So, Toby, a quiet news day today.
Yeah, look, it's been a really delightful day. I had a long, wonderful show planned, you know, lots of great interviews with, you know, lots of members of the LGBTIQ plus community, and then old ScoMo had to go out and ruin it, like many things to do with the LGBTI plus community.
So you weren't expecting him to call it today?
Well, no. I think that most people were predicting that he'd do it on a Sunday. For whatever reason, that traditionally usually is when the Prime Minister of the day goes and visits the Governor-General. ScoMo chose to do it this Thursday, largely because by not going last Sunday, he was able to spend the last 4 days spending about, they estimate, $600,000 a day of taxpayer money on government ads. Government ads that are there to promote government programs, but conveniently happen to also be obviously pushing the coalition's policies. I don't know if people have been listening to things like SoundCloud or YouTube. You may have suddenly noticed you were all of a sudden getting ads about tax cuts. That's your money going to inconvenience you. So good times. The reason he went today was because he guaranteed he'd get more headlines.
Basically. Well, he does love a headline, doesn't ScoMo?
He's a marketing man. He's a marketing man through and through. He loves the attention. It's been quite an emotional parliament, and now that we're going to be moving into election mode, we're kind of going to forget now that whole phase of just how crazy the last few years. Obviously, Australian politics has been crazy for quite a long time, the past decade really. But this previous parliament has been particularly mad. I caught up with Paul Karp, The Guardian's political reporter, earlier today to find out what covering parliament has been like and also which of the major parties has better policies for the LGBTIQ plus community. Paul, are you going to miss the 45th Parliament?
Well, it was a kind of mad and bad Parliament, the 45th. The first entire term of Parliament I've covered, and I don't think it's like any session that preceded it. I mean, you had a whole bunch of MPs and senators chucked out for being dual citizens, and that saw a whole batch of people that weren't at the top of their party's tickets get elected. Some of them, like Senator Fraser Anning, had rather unsavoury views.
Genuinely
mind
nutty.
You, some of the people that were elected, like Pauline Hanson, had unsavoury views as
she
well.
She wore a burqa, she ripped the burqa off. Like, it was just unbelievable. Like, it made Married at First Sight and shows like that look positively normal.
Yes, it's parliamentary stunts and racist rhetoric. There were some low points in the 45th Parliament.
Yeah. What's the sense within the coalition going into the election campaign?
I think that they are the underdogs, but they are encouraged by a narrowing in the polls. I mean, most of them seem to have it 52-48. So the mood is, optimistic that an upset is possible, but you would rather be in Labor's position than the coalition, because they're already in minority government, so they actually need to win seats to get back into majority.
And because of seat redistributions, that the maths of that becomes quite a bit harder as well. It was also interesting, but it seems like time moves so much faster now. When you were talking before about all those pollies being knocked out for being unconstitutionally elected, I'd kind of forgotten about that, but of course that was this huge ongoing rolling drama. Another example was the budget, which just seemed to disappear.
Yes, usually governments like to deliver budgets and then spend a few weeks selling the benefits to voters. But because the election had to follow so quick on the heels of the budget, one of the consequences of that is it's kind of sunk like a stone. The government wants people to remember that they've projected a surplus for the next year, but I doubt people would remember very much else about it.
Absolutely. We've actually done a budget unpacking some of the policies that have particular implications for the LGBTIQ community. There were measures involving the funding of HIV services, which are good. There's more money flowing to mental health services, and a lot of those have been matched by Labor as well. In terms of balancing the two major parties, when it comes to LGBTIQ plus issues, who do you think is better?
Now that we've passed through marriage equality, I'm not sure it will be a huge focus of the campaign. I know one of the major asks of LGBT activists has been gay conversion therapy to be banned. It seems to be more of a state issue, but federal Labor might have something in that space to coordinate that nationally. Mm-hmm. But really, it's going to be more about individual politicians' attitudes to the LGBT community rather than hard policies. I think a lot of people will have trouble forgetting disparaging remarks made about the Safe Schools program by coalition parliamentarians, and that's the sort of thing that it would be a good reason to mark them down for people in the queer community, I think.
Absolutely. And just a couple of days ago, this didn't get remarked on because there's been so much build up to the election, but the religious exemptions bill, also I think the deadline for passing that legislation quietly passed. That was a result coming out of the Ruddock review. I believe Scott Morrison had committed to passing elements of that. It had kind of been moved to a parliamentary committee, and now that's kind of floated away into the ether. Where did the party's positions wind up on religious exemptions? That's the religious exemptions for religious schools and organisations to fire gay teachers and expel gay students.
Yeah, so after the Ruddock review was leaked, there was a week where people were kind of frantically studying up what discrimination law said and were horrified that discrimination against LGBT staff and students is allowed in most states. Scott Morrison made a commitment to stop discrimination against students, matching a commitment that Labor made, but talks between the parties broke down because the coalition proposed further exemptions to that Labor said would neuter the entire point of extending protection. Mm-hmm. So maybe you couldn't expel students for being gay, but you could sit them down and make them write lines about it being immoral, for example, is an example of what the sort of loophole they were worried would be opened.
Okay.
So in the end, they didn't get anywhere. Both promised to prevent expulsion, but the bill hasn't passed.
And I believe another area of difference that I've just recorded is actually the school chaplains program, which the coalition actually has funded or committed to funding last year, I think, but it happens to be in this budget. And I think Labor's going to fund that, but schools will have a choice between a chaplain and a qualified mental health counsellor. So that'd be kind of one of the other differences. And who do you think is going to win the election? Sorry to put you on the spot on the first day. We literally, I think you probably called it 4 hours ago.
I think Labor is box seat. It's not unlosable. And, you know, Michael Daly, the opposition leader in New South Wales, looked like he was winning right up until the last week. So anything can happen. But given the swing in the national polls and vulnerability, particularly in Victorian seats, I think Labor will win.
That was Paul Karp from The Guardian. You're listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Got a story? Got a news tip? Want us to dig into something? We want to hear from you. Email us, theinformer@joy.org.au, or text us at 0427 Joy 949.
It's been lost in the election announcement today, but Australia got a budget a mere week ago. There was almost no analysis of what that budget and Labor's alternative would mean for LGBTIQ plus communities. To find out what the parties are offering, Toby Halligan spoke to Daryl O'Donnell from the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations.
What measures are contained within the budget that might have implications for the LGBTIQ plus community?
Well, look, I think in this year's budget, the standout measure, it really has to be the HIV commitment. So the federal government in this budget has announced $45.4 million commitment to drive down rates of HIV, but also to address other bloodborne viruses and STIs. And this really is a very, very important commitment. It's the largest new investment of money in this area that we've seen in at least two decades. So it's a very welcome commitment.
And where will that money go?
Well, it actually has a number of different components within it. So of the $45 million, around $20 million of that is actually set aside to address very high rates of bumble viruses and endemic rates of STIs among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And this really is a very neglected area that hasn't had the investment required, the effort required to address those rates. And there's also investments in here for a new STI or sexual health awareness campaign, a national, possibly a TV campaign, but a national campaign. It's been a long time since we've seen those large-scale whole-of-community advertising on these issues, and that provides, you know, that's very important in terms of people just remaining aware that sexual health is important for all of us who are sexually active.
Mm-hmm. And my understanding is the ALP is matching that commitment from the coalition, and I believe they've offered extra money?
That's right. So the Labor Party has had a policy on its approach to HIV since December 2017, and so that commitment remains live. So if there is a change of government, the forthcoming election, Labor has committed to provide $39 million over 3 years to really intensify efforts to drive HIV to very low levels in Australia. Mm. And that's an incredibly welcome commitment because, you know, we've got all of the technology we need to really break the back of the HIV epidemic in this country and to reduce the burden it has for our communities. But we need the firepower to really scale up those efforts.
Mm-hmm. And are there other budget measures that will impact on the LGBTIQ plus community?
Well, there are. As we all know, there's a range of health issues where for people in our communities we're experiencing a disproportionate burden of poorer health. So things like youth suicide or mental health funding is obviously of interest. New investments on alcohol and other drugs are of interest. But one of the very striking things about the budget is that beyond the HIV investment, there's actually very little in the budget papers that indicates that there's specific attention being put into the health of our communities. So while we're really pleased to see new investments in mental health and in other areas, we'd also like to be seeing that there's a recognition of the disproportionate impact in our communities and that there's specific funding for our communities to address these issues.
I know there's talk of, previously this was ended by Tony Abbott, who was the Women's Minister at the time in 2014. There was a women's statement on the budget that provided an analysis on the particular impact the budget would have on women. Do you think it's time that, given that the LGBTIQ plus community represents 10, 12, percent of the community, depending on whose figures you take, and it is subject to a number of particular pressures, do you think it's time that there was a rainbow statement or equivalent on the budget?
I think it would be an excellent thing because it would bring transparency. There is actually, important federal investment in health initiatives for our communities. So it's not that there's nothing, but it's just that it's not very visible in this federal budget. And that obviously creates a question in all of our minds about, well, what is in there and how much of it can we be assured will actually flow through for the benefit of our communities. And so, so the sort of statement you're describing, I think, would bring real transparency to this. But it would also focus the minds of government and policymakers that, our communities don't do as well as many others in terms of our health outcomes, and there are differences and needs that we have that should be reflected in budget measures and in program design.
That was Daryl O'Donnell from the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations. Here on The Informer, we appreciate your feedback and your questions. To contribute, send your message to 0427 JOY949 or email on air at joy.org.au. One of the major critiques of the Coalition is that it's failed to represent women adequately. The Liberal Party in particular has very low rates of female representation, making up just 21% of the party's parliamentarians. As a result, women have once again done poorly out of the Coalition's budget. Tanya Kovach, Senior Fellow Gender Equity at Per Capita, explains why.
So was this budget a good budget for Australia's women?
Oh, look, I think one of the very clearest spaces where women have missed out is in the budget's complete silence in relation to New Start and, you know, low-income workers. The budget package has not provided any support for women and not just women but men too, who are at the lower end of the wage gap. Mm. And it's really very obvious that the budget has been geared towards to an election and to a top end of town, really.
Mm. And that top end of town, so, for example, the Coalition's tax cuts, which will be implemented in three phases, and the final phase, which ostensibly would kick in 2024, would flatten the tax rate between $45,000 and $200,000 a year at a flat 30%. So if you're on $45,000, you're paying the same portion of your income in tax as someone on $200,000. And obviously that disproportionately favours men, doesn't it? Because they tend to be higher income earners.
Absolutely. And women, what we know is that women are still experiencing disadvantage across their employment life, across their employment life cycle, despite the fact that Australia has got the highest rate in the world of the education of girls. We have a terrible slide down the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Index in the workplace. Mm. And so we have a lot of women languishing in underemployment, casualised jobs and part-time work when they really don't want to be. Mm. But the nature of the lack of detail, and I would say to you that the reason that we have inadequate paid parental leave, difficulties in poor service provision in childcare, and a range of sort of other intersectional problems for women that prohibits them from having equality in the workforce is because we do not have a thorough gender lens nationally over our budget cycle. Mm. And we've lost the expertise to be able to do that, and it needs to be fixed very quickly if we are going to address that gender gap.
That was Tanya Kovach from Per Capita.
This is The Informer, a Joy 94.9 podcast.
Tasmania's LGBTIQ plus laws for many years lagged behind the rest of the country. Homosexuality was only legalised back in 1997 and cross-dressing was illegal up until 2000. But a recent push from the trans and gender diverse communities in Tasmania have seen both houses of parliament pass laws that will make Tasmania a national leader in trans and gender diverse rights. While the laws have one final parliamentary hurdle to overcome, Toby Halligan spoke to Transforming Tasmania's Martine Delaney about the campaign and why equality activists can't just settle for crumbs.
Martine, can you summarise what is actually going to change with these laws?
A couple of things, Toby. Basically, the laws will create a situation where a trans or gender diverse person who has a birth certificate which outs them every time they use it will be able to change that birth certificate so that it either carries the gender, has a gender marker which matches their public identity, or has no gender marker at all. And they can do that by choice. And that can happen for anybody over the age of 16, under the age of 16, a child who's transitioning with their family can, with their parents' support, achieve the same thing.
And that's a pretty remarkable turnaround. I saw your piece in The Guardian this week discussing how Tasmania's gone from being a position of being one of the worst states in Australia to one of the best in a world leader, really. How has that journey happened?
Well, I think as I mentioned in that article, there's been quite a few things have gone into it. The fact that we had that huge, long, drawn-out decriminalisation campaign back in the 80s and 90s meant that LGBTI issues came up and governments and parliament had to look at the process. And it began a slow process of changing things. But in more recent times, there's been an incredibly concerted campaign by Transforming Tasmania, by Tasmanian parents of trans kids, and a whole lot of allies and supporters to make sure that parliamentarians understood the issues, despite all the misinformation that's been out there. They understand those things.
In that piece in The Guardian, you talk about the importance of being bold, especially given that the Tasmanian government actually still opposes these changes. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. That's probably one of the really big things about this is that, and it's not just about the changing of birth certificates. Sorry, I failed to mention that in changing your gender, you want to, previously you had to use. Have stat deaths from medical practitioners to say that you'd undergone reassignment surgery, etc. That will no longer be necessary. And also, along with the other steps, it means that you will not have to be divorced if you are married and have transitioned in order to get it, which is where this whole thing started, and that's where we talk about being bold. Since December 2017, states and territories which had not already removed that forced divorce requirement had to do that to fit in with a clause within the Marriage Act amendment that was passed in 2017. And here in Tasmania, we sort of put it to the government that they had to do that by December 2018, and we felt that needed to go further. And rather than sitting back and simply saying, yep, we'll settle for the forced divorce, which in reality probably affects a handful of people. You know, there are only a handful in Tasmania. There would be a tiny handful of people whose marriages had survived the transition process and who were being forced to divorce if they wished to change their birth certificate. And that these other issues around your name and gender on your birth certificate were far more important for far more trans and gender diverse people. So we basically went to the government in April last year, and after many, many months of this, the Attorney General refusing to sort of agree to work with us or in fact help in any way to progress the process, we then began lobbying the opposition and the Greens, as well as talking with the government speaker of the House, Sue Hickey, and were able to get the numbers within the lower house to in fact get a whole heap of amendments made to the government's bill, which was only about forced divorce. So it was about being bold. It was about saying, no, let's not just settle for what the government is willing to give us. Let's push to get those things that trans and gender diverse Tasmanians need in order to just have a reasonable life.
One of the other things you talk about in your Guardian piece was the importance of personal stories in framing the debate and in shaping it. What can you give me an example of an impact that they had, or how they impacted on the debate?
This is something which, you know, it became a big part of the marriage equality campaign around the country, and it's something which pretty much I think you can sheet back, give responsibility right back to Rodney Croom. Way long, long ago, it became Rodney's practice in when you're trying to shift parliamentarians to confront them with real-life stories, make that issue a real personal thing, give them contact with people who are affected. And one of the the most powerful parts of the Transforming Tasmania campaign has been getting the parents and some young, you know, teenage and young adult trans people to visit, sit and talk with members of both houses of parliament and say, this is the reality of our lives and please, will you stop and listen? Mm. And that has an enormous effect. It's an incredibly powerful thing.
Mm.
And it's done its work in this instance.
You spoke about prejudice that you've encountered over the course of this debate. Can you give me some examples?
It comes in all shapes and forms. It comes in the form of full page advertisements in the major Tasmanian paper funded by the Catholic Church, which set out a whole lot of misinformation, which is designed to put people off being supportive of the thing. It comes in the form of just, you know, page after page after page of foul comments on online posts about the reforms. Rallies and forums being held to try and things that give very strong messages to trans and gender diverse people, and particularly harming kids, that you are not accepted for who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty ugly.
Mm.
That is really ugly. And when a government takes no steps to combat that, and in fact, through its own media releases, then adds fuel to the fire by claiming that there are all sorts of unintended consequences going to fall upon us, then you're putting vulnerable people into a pretty invidious spot.
So given Tasmania's now, leading the nation, what message would you have for other trans and gender fluid activists around the country who are pushing for equality in this space?
We've got an example here in Tasmania happening. It's happened in other parts of the world. You know, Malta and other parts have done similar things. And I have to be careful because I wrote an opinion piece some months ago calling on other activists around the country not to settle for forced divorce, and got myself into a bit of trouble with people. But it is one of saying, look, governments will only ever give you as much as they have to if there is any possibility of it being an issue in the public arena. And the important thing is about moving parliament. If you look at the whole decriminalisation process in Tasmania, the parliament ended up passing laws which weren't supported by a majority in the public. But when parliament passed those laws, and over the next couple of years, the voting world out there saw that the sky hadn't fallen down, that the sun still came up every morning, public opinion started to shift.
Mm.
Parliaments do not have to wait. Governments do not have to wait. Governments, through a legislative process, can in fact bring about change within society. And that's what we're doing here.
Mm.
Very clearly what we're doing here.
When you say you got into trouble, in what way, what do you mean?
Look, there are a few activists and lobbyists around the country who felt that I was being a bit unfair in saying that they should have been asking for more and not simply accepting what governments were offering. And that's pretty much, you know, here in Tasmania, we chose not to accept the government's offer because the government's offer was only forced divorce, the removal of forced divorce, and we kept on saying no. It's really not very much, so we want more, please.
I mean, it does seem to be, though, like this ongoing tension within, in particular, the LGBTI plus Q communities around how we actually achieve meaningful reform, whether or not we should be more aggressive or make concessions. And it seems, yeah, Tasmania, on the face of it, is an example of the ability for LGBTI plus Q activists to convince parliamentarians, even in the face of ostensive public opposition, which, I mean, is often going to be the case, surely, given it seems we're often
Absolutely.
Dealing with extremely hostile media organisations that frankly, don't tell the stories of, in particular, trans and gender diverse people in a fair and balanced way.
No, they don't. You know, I saw a piece this morning. I think it was this morning from Miranda Devine in the Daily Telegraph or whatever it's called, which is, it was just wrong on so many points. It showed such a lack of understanding or a lack of research. But it that sort of stuff influences a lot of people. You also have, you know, there are also interest groups, religious organisation, right-wing conservative groups who, for their own ideological reasons, are trying to slow this stuff down, are trying to stop reform from happening, and they come out with the most outlandish stuff. So it is always going to be an aggressive thing, and then it becomes, you know, LGBTIQ plus lobbyists and activists do not have the resources of those major organisations to combat what they do. We can't put full-page advertisements in newspapers. So we have to look about how, and we have to look at how we do that. And it's about, yeah, it goes back to being bold, being brave, and not settling for the crumbs, because we will only be given crumbs without pushing for them.
That was Transforming Tasmania's Martine Delaney. That's all from this episode of The Informer. We've also posted an extended interview about the impact the laws in Brunei have had on Muslims in Australia, and a special report from Ian Muchamore on anxiety in the LGBTIQ plus community. If you enjoyed this episode, please review it and subscribe. Thanks to David Moyle and all of our guests. Goodbye until next week's episode at 7 p.m. next Thursday night.
This has been The Informer. If you're interested in LGBTIQ+ news from around the world, why not listen to Worldwide Wave?